Hi, my name is Max, and I'm a happy member of Al-Anon. People ask me if I get nervous, and usually, you know, I just don't think about it, so then I don't get nervous till I get up here. But because the meeting started so late, I've been getting more and more uptight, so usually I lose my voice, so if I don't talk or I can't talk, you'll know what's the matter. I want to thank the committee for inviting us to come. We appreciate that. The other thing I like to say is that Paul always says I give the perverted version of his story. And I just like to remind all of you that I was the one that was sober. So you can draw your own conclusions. Another thing, so I don't forget this, I guess you call it detachment back here in Al-Anon. We call it release with love. And I don't usually tell jokes, but I heard this joke, and it reminds me so much of detachment or release with love. There was a woman got theater tickets to Phantom of the Opera when they were hard to get. And so she went to the theater, and pretty soon another woman came in, and they got to talking, and there was an empty seat between them. And the second woman said, isn't it a shame that nobody has this seat when the tickets are so hard to get? And the first woman said, well, that belongs to my husband. And the second woman said, well, where is he? And she said, he died. And she said, oh, well, I'm sorry. She said, but couldn't you have found a relative or friend to give the ticket to? She said, they're all at the funeral. That's detachment. Anyway, I wouldn't have come to Al-Anon in 100 years because I didn't think that our problem had anything to do with drinking. I thought Paul was crazy. So my solution was to try to find him a psychiatrist. And he wouldn't go, so I went. And I thought that if I went, I could maneuver him into going. Well, it didn't work. He never did go, and I ended up going 3.5 years. I went to 4 different ones, and I didn't learn anything about myself. In fact, I always went to the psychiatrist who didn't talk, and I would go and sit, and they would sit, and then I would think of all this money it was costing me, and somebody had to talk. So I would tell them what Paul was doing and what my older daughter was doing, and each week I'd go back and give them a new story. The first one I went to, everything I said, he laughed. And I really didn't like him because I didn't think the things I was telling him were funny. Anyway, after I'd gone to him for about 6 months, Paul decided that I was such a mess that he was going to take me over to Westwood, which is part of Los Angeles, and have me hypnotized. And when I told the psychiatrist this, he said, if you do that, don't come back. So that was my out, and I didn't have to go to him anymore. He had me tested when I went to him. I took the Minnesota Multiphasic Test. Maybe some of you have taken that. It's about, what, 1,200 or 600 questions? I don't know. And it seemed to me that they were trying to trick me because they would ask a question, and then about 10 down was the same question, only worded a little differently. So I was very careful when I took that. And then I took the Rorschach test, which is the ink blot test, and I had heard that that had something to do with sex, so I was particularly careful with that one. And I only saw animals. And when he gave me the results, he told me I was very rigid and would never change. And I was horrified because I was the only one doing anything about this mess. Paul wasn't doing anything. And here was this professional saying, you might as well give up because nothing's going to change. Anyway, after Paul decided about the hypnosis, I didn't go back to him. Anyway, he took me into Westwood for 6 Wednesdays, which was our day off. Paul had tried to hypnotize me one time. He had taken some courses in hypnosis, and we used to go to Las Vegas, and I would sit in on sessions, and they were kind of interesting. But anyway, Paul told me I had to relax, so he gave me a Miltown so I would relax. And he told me to lie on the couch, and I went to sleep. So he wouldn't do it anymore, but he thought this fella could. I don't think he did either. We went 6 times. And then he referred me to somebody in Anaheim, because that's where we lived at the time. Anyway, I ended up going to 4, and the last one I went to was in Long Beach, because I worked in the office with Paul, and it seemed to me that every time I started with some psychiatrist, Paul would start sending his patients there, and I felt a little silly, you know, sitting in the psychiatrist's waiting room, and the patients would come in and see me, and they knew who I was. And anyway, I made my appointments very early in the morning, and I left by a back door. Anyway, after I went to this last one, he wanted to see Paul after I'd gone a short time. So I talked Paul into going, and he went into the psychiatrist's office and stayed about 5 minutes and came out and said, "I have nothing to say." And so that was the end of that. And a funny thing happened after we came to the program. Dr. Persh, who was in charge of the Navy Alcoholism Program there in Long Beach, asked Paul to be on a panel. And we just assumed it was something for the Navy, and it was a dinner meeting, so I didn't go. And when Paul came home around 11 o'clock, he was all excited because they had talked to the Long Beach Medical Association. And he said he noticed this one doctor sitting on the edge of his chair, nodding and smiling, and he thought, gee, this guy must really be interested in alcoholism. And afterwards, he came running up to Paul and said, "Remember me?" And Paul said, "Were you at the VA hospital?" He said, "No, I was one of your wife's psychiatrists." And that was the fellow that I'd gotten Paul to go see. And he was delighted and acted like he knew all along what the problem was. But I really don't think so, because after we came to the program, Paul sent literature and a letter to all of my psychiatrists and told them that I was on Al-Anon, he was on AA, and if they'd like to talk to us, we'd be glad to talk to them. We never heard from any of them. Anyway, so I really don't think that he knew. And I also went to priests, and I didn't go to the parish priest, I'd go to somebody I didn't know. And I heard about this chaplain over at St. Joseph's Hospital in Orange, and I called and made an appointment with him. And I didn't bother to tell Paul where I was going, and I was gone for hours. And this priest said what he usually did in marriage counseling, he would talk to the wife alone, and then he would talk to the husband alone, and then he talked to the two of us together. So when I got home, Paul wanted to know where I'd been, and I told him, and I said, "He wants to see you." So he very reluctantly agreed he would go, and I got on the phone and made the appointment for the next day. And he went over, and he was gone a long time too, and when he came back, he was furious. And I said, "Are we going to go see him together?" And he said, "No, I'm not going back." So I waited till the next day to call the priest to find out what happened. And the priest said, "Your husband is the most stubborn man I've ever seen." And that was the whole explanation. We found out later when we came to the program that this priest was also an alcoholic, drinking at the time. So no wonder they didn't get along. I made a married couple's retreat, and I went alone. Nobody thought this was strange. You know, my husband was a doctor, he couldn't get away, but I really went to talk to the priest. And I talked to him for several hours, and he came to the same conclusion that I did, that Paul needed psychiatric care. But I didn't know how to get him there. So we had absolutely no communication, and it seemed to me that if I were in the living room, Paul would be in the bedroom or vice versa. So we spent very little time together. And even when we were at the office, I really didn't see him because I worked at the front desk. And if I had something to tell him, I would just put a note in the workroom and then he'd answer. And that was our communication. Anyway, one Sunday morning, I was showing him some rust spots on the floor in our family room. And all of a sudden, he was on the floor having a convulsion. Now, I had never seen anyone have a convulsion before, so I was terrified. And I called the doctor on the next block, and finally he got there. And by that time, Paul had awakened, or whatever you do when you come out of a convulsion. And Art decided that he should go in the hospital. So he called an ambulance, and I rode in the ambulance with Paul. And when he got there, he wouldn't stay unless I stayed overnight. So I stayed overnight in the next bed. And in the morning, he felt fine and came home. While he was there, Nerala saw him, and he wanted Paul to come in his office the following Wednesday and have some lab tests. So I had to drive him over there because of the convulsion. And when we walked into the doctor's office, Paul proceeded to tell him the only problem was it was a marital problem. Now, I couldn't understand how I could cause him to have a convulsion. But if he said so, it had to be true. I believed everything he said, you know. I thought he was crazy, but if he said it, it was gospel truth. I've learned on Al-Anon that that ain't necessarily so. Anyway, he refused to have any of the tests, and we went back to living the way we had been. Periodically, I would decide that we were never going to get anything settled unless we talked. And so I would wait till about 11 o'clock at night, and by that time, Paul had had a few drinks and a few pills, and that was my time to have the serious conversation. And it always ended up the same way. I'd cry and he'd be mad. And then I'd wait a couple days and think, well, I didn't word that right. And I would try again. Of course, I didn't do anything different. I did the same thing over and over and over. And eventually, I just gave up and thought, you know, what I thought communication was that I would talk until Paul agreed with me. And that never happens. And I don't think it ever will happen. But today, I give Paul the right to be wrong. Anyway, my methods of communication didn't work very well. Anyway, then 14 months after the first convulsion, I was in the living room one Saturday night watching television, and I heard this noise back in the bedroom, and I walked back, and there's Paul on the floor having a convulsion. So I sat down on the edge of the bed and I watched him. And when he finished, I said, you've had a convulsion, you better go to bed. And I hadn't even been to Al-Anon yet. Anyway, the next morning I called this neurologist. I called him for everything because several of the doctors in our building approached me about Paul's change of personality, and I would agree, but that's all I would say because I thought if I told them how we were living, Paul would kill me. But this fellow we didn't know socially, so I called him every time anything happened. And he threw me off because he told me that Paul either had a brain tumor or early senility or something else, I don't remember. And then Paul told me he had a brain tumor, so, you know, if he said it, it had to be true. So I was focused in on that. Well, anyway, I called this neurologist the next day after the second convulsion. And I don't know whether he was just sick of me or what, but he suggested Paul go back to the Mayo Clinic. And he said that he had trained there and he would write a letter and get him in. Well, it took a month to get that appointment. And during that month, Paul changed his mind, I don't know how many times, so I didn't know until the last minute whether we were going or not, but we did go back, middle of December. And I made up my mind that I was going to get in and see this neurosurgeon and tell him about the pills that Paul was taking. At that time, I really didn't realize what pills could do to you, but the only thing, the only event that made me aware, was there was a young doctor in our town, and all the medical community knew that he took drugs, and he eventually overdosed, and I thought, gee, you know, Paul could die too, and I didn't really know what to do about it. So I thought, well, when we get back to Rochester, Minnesota, I'm going to go talk to that doctor. Well, Paul started through the clinic on a Monday, and it took me till Thursday to get up enough courage to go over to try to see this doctor. And they had this huge waiting room. I think it was as big as this room, and everybody in there was a patient. And if you were a patient, you had a number. Well, I wasn't a patient, and I didn't have a number, and I don't know what I told that gal, but she let me in. And I told the doctor that he was taking some kind of pills. I didn't know what he was taking. I assumed they were sleeping pills because he'd get up at night. Anyway, Paul went back the next day to get his lab reports, and they locked him up in the nut ward. And I went over to see him, and he wanted out. And the only way he could get out was if I agreed to take responsibility for him. And I didn't know whether I should do that or not. But anyway, he told me that if I didn't agree, he'd never speak to me again. So what could I do? I didn't know what a good opportunity that was. he told me he wouldn't drink anymore and he wouldn't take any pills or medicine or anything. And so I agreed, and I think, because it was the day before Christmas, and I don't think we got out on Christmas, I think it was the next day, we got on the plane and had a big fight over whether or not he'd drink the free booze. I won. He didn't drink, but he wouldn't talk or eat either all the way back to California. And when he got back, he bought himself a bottle of scotch and drank it all. And I was frantic, you know. I was up at 4 o'clock the next morning. I really didn't know what to do because I thought I had gotten my last chance to get him medical help. So anyway, finally it was 9 o'clock and I could call this neurologist and tell him what happened. And he asked me whether I thought Paul would see a local psychiatrist. And I said, well, I don't know, I've tried that before, but it didn't seem to work. But this was our first miracle, because I didn't know this, but in my searching for a psychiatrist, I tried to get in to see this fellow. And I thought the only day I could go was Wednesday, which was our day off at the office. And the girl just said, we're not here on Wednesday, and hung up. And I never had the courage to call back. But I'm glad that it worked out the way I did, where it did, because I think if I had been in there manipulating, maneuvering, it wouldn't have turned out the same way. Because this doctor is not an alcoholic, but on his internship was required to go to one or two AA meetings. And he was so impressed with AA that now practically all of his practice is alcoholics, and then he sends them off to AA. Anyway, so he talked to Paul for 45 minutes and talked to me for 10 minutes and locked him up in the local nut ward. And I knew he was in the right place. And I could go see him every day for an hour. Now, Paul spent his time locked up in the nut ward making lists of things for me to do to keep the world running while he was locked up in the nut ward. And he had to be pretty crazy to do that. But not nearly as crazy as me going over each day for my list, like I did. One day on the list was to go over to the central office and pick up the big book. And I thought, what does he want the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for? I mean, I'd heard of AA, I'd heard of Al-Anon. In fact, 10 years before I came to the program, I had sent back to New York for Al-Anon literature for Paul's patients. But I didn't read it. Why would I read that stuff? Anyway, and then he was going to AA. This psychiatrist had somebody picking him up and taking AA. I was just completely confused. Anyway, I don't know how many meetings he had gone to. On a Saturday night, I went over and this AA fellow came in. And Paul introduced us, and Frank said, we're going to an AA meeting tonight. Would you like to go along? I didn't have anything else to do, so I said, okay. And we got in the car with this guy, and I thought he was a real kook. He was telling us all kinds of personal things. And you don't talk to strangers like that. He was telling us how he and his wife had broken up, and he was trying to get back together with her, so he gave her guitar lessons for Christmas. And then she ran off with a guitar teacher. And I thought, my God, what have we gotten into, you know? And he took us to Laguna Beach from Orange, which took about 40, 45 minutes, and he talked all the way down. Paul and I didn't say a word. And when we got to the Canyon Club, we got together and decided we weren't going with him anymore. Anyway, like I say, I had no idea. We never knew anybody on AA or Al-Anon, so I had no idea what to expect. And a visiting group used to come in on that Saturday night meeting, and I remember walking in the Canyon Club and being so afraid we'd run into somebody we knew, and we didn't for a year, and I'm grateful for that. But anyway, when the meeting started, they turned off all the lights and just had candles, and then I could be comfortable. Now, I don't know anything that was said, but they laughed, and I hadn't laughed in a long time, and I really enjoyed the meeting, and I wanted to come back, but I don't think I went to too many meetings while Paul was in the hospital. But anyway, then Frank had this Al-Anon gal call me, And I didn't like her at all. You know, she called me up a dozen times a day. And I didn't have time to talk on the phone to strangers about Al-Anon, whatever that was. But I finally agreed that I would go to a meeting with her. And she also took me to Laguna Beach. The meeting started at 12. I had to be at her house at 10 o'clock. I didn't get home till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I couldn't take all that time. Besides, I worked, and I had a thing about wasting my time. And I didn't like women's clubs. And things were better. Paul was locked up. I knew where he was. But I went to 3 meetings with her. And then she started calling me and telling me I shouldn't work for Paul. And that did it. I mean, I didn't get paid, but it was a job. And I told her what she could do with Al-Anon. But when Paul got out of the hospital, then I continued to go to AA meetings, speaker meetings with him. And we went down to Laguna because we couldn't figure out the schedule. And so if we got down there too early, it was a little hard for us to judge how long it would take. We'd go to Denny's or someplace and have a soda so that we didn't get in there too early. The meeting started at 8:30. We would get in there at 29 minutes after 8. Sit by the door, and they didn't have a coffee break, and as soon as they said the Lord's Prayer, we were out the door, and then we complained because no one was friendly. Nobody talked to us, you know. They didn't know we existed for the first year. Anyway, so that's the way we went to meetings, and we enjoyed the meetings. I guess we thought of them as more as somebody going to the bottom and then pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. Anyway, and Paul would go to one or two meetings a week, whether he needed them or not. And we didn't understand what they were talking about either, because they would talk about 502s, which was a drunk driving charge in California at that time. Paul never had a 502. He drank at home. And they'd talk about being 86th out of some bar. Never had that experience. We didn't know what that meant either. And I remember one time going to this AA meeting, this alcoholic woman got up and said she always wanted to be a hooker. And I turned to Paul and I said, what's a hooker? I've been very sheltered. I learned a whole new language here. Anyway, then 10 months later, after Paul had started AA, we went to the Southern California Convention in Anaheim, and we just lived about 5 minutes away from the convention center. And I went on Saturday afternoon. I have no idea why I went. But anyway, I went in and sat in the back of the room. And one of the gals who had been in the car when I went to those 3 Al-Anon meetings came over and spoke to me and said, why don't you come and sit with us? And I was very grateful to Martha because I certainly didn't feel a part of. So for the first time, I heard something. There were 4 women talked, and they talked on release with love. And that was the first time I heard something, and I decided that maybe Al-Anon did have something, and I would give it another try. But I thought Laguna was too far, so I went to some meetings closer to home. 6 weeks, I think, I went to this other one. And even as sick as I was, I realized that they were living in the problem rather than the answer. And I wasn't getting anything out of these meetings. So I decided to go back to Laguna. And I was scared to death because that was a big meeting at that time, 60 or 70 people. And everybody knew all these things that I didn't know. And I had no idea how they found this out because I sure didn't know these things. Anyway, and I would go in and they had tables set up. And I would try to figure out where I could sit that no one would notice me. And it seemed like no matter where I sat, that's where they started. And I'm thinking, my God, you know, what am I going to say? These people say all these profound things that I've never heard. And then we do a lot of reading in our meetings, and one of them is the 3 obstacles. And they talk about you do it your own way in your own time. And that gave me permission to not talk. So for the first year, I only said, my name is Maxine, and I pass. And I remember the first time I did have something to say, that day they didn't call on me. anyway, gradually I got comfortable in that meeting. And today, you know, when I first heard people talk about being comfortable and happy and grateful, I wanted to vomit. How could anybody be grateful that their husband was an alcoholic? And yet today I am grateful because I've learned things in this program that there's no way that I could have learned if I hadn't gone. Anyway, I think those women in that meeting thought I was never going to talk, and I didn't plan to either. And the reason I'm doing this is that in 1970, we went to the International Convention in Miami, and Al-Anon had put out a new book called The Best of the Forum. And the Forum is like the grapevine in AA. It comes out in New York. And my first mistake was I bought that book, because when I started to read it, I found, it seemed to me that they were saying that it was your responsibility to share with others because others had shared with you. And so then I got to feeling guilty. And Paul had been talking since after maybe the first year, and then people would ask me to talk, and I'd go, no, I don't talk. So anyway, I thought, well, okay. Next time somebody asks me to talk, I'll talk. And if they don't like me, they don't need to ask me back. And they didn't. Anyway, that made it more comfortable for me to talk, because I only have my story, and I don't really have a very dramatic story. I've told people, you know, I could sum my whole story up in stupidity and denial and sit down. Anyway, I've learned many things. Al-Anon has helped me in areas that have nothing to do with alcoholism. It's helped me with my kids. And they've done things that I couldn't have handled if I hadn't had Al-Anon. So I'm grateful for that reason. When I first started Al-Anon, everything I did, Paul would say, don't give me that Al-Anon crap. This is for real. And so then he decided to come to Al-Anon to see what was really going on. And he found out that we don't talk about the alcoholic. We have much more important things to talk about. And he loved it. And he stayed at that time for a year and a half, but then he was in practice, so he couldn't always come. But now he comes with me every Monday, and I'm grateful for that, too, because he not only has seen that we don't concentrate, if you have a good Al-Anon, maybe you don't concentrate on the alcoholic, you take care of yourself. And I think he's learned a few tricks, too, from Al-Anon. I'm grateful that he goes with me. When I first went to Al-Anon and they'd read the do's and don'ts, that was another thing they read. They'd talk about don't pour out liquor and don't hide liquor. And I think the first word I heard was resentment. Of course, I didn't have any of those. And then after I was around a little while, they sort of bubbled up. And I didn't hide liquor, and I didn't pour out liquor. And like I say, after a while, my understanding of what was going on changed a little bit, because during the drinking, Paul would get up in the morning sometimes and say he wasn't going to drink anymore, and that we were going to change all our friends. And I thought, this is just one of his kooky ideas. How can we change all our friends? There was no way that I thought we could change friends, which is exactly what we've done. And I'd help him pour out the beer. And I'd think, I'm not going to buy as much anymore because this is a waste. And I like beer, you know. So anyway, but that night, then he'd say to me, why don't you go to the store and get me 3 cans of beer? And we'd argue a little bit, and I'd always end up going. And I'd feel silly taking 3 cans out of a six-pack, but I'd do it. And I'd come home, and on the way home, I'd think, well, when I get home, I'll have one. Well, when I got there, he didn't want me to have one. And I couldn't understand when I was good enough to go get it. I guess I could have bought 4. That never occurred to me. But knowing what I know now, if I had bought 4, he would have wanted 4. And then the other thing, every Christmas, Paul treated a doctor and his family, and every Christmas, Charlie would give Paul a case of scotch. And he'd drink a couple bottles, and the rest I'd hide. And I'd hide them up in my dresser, or in the dresser drawers, and up in the cupboard, and then periodically I'd go back and I'd count them, and then I couldn't remember how many I'd put there in the first place. And one time I had one quart left over and I had no place at home to put it. So I took it down to the office and we had an L-shaped desk and with a cupboard under there that we'd never used. So I thought that's a good place for it. So I pushed this quart of scotch in and it clinked up against another bottle. And I reached in and got an empty half pint of scotch. And I thought, those stupid cleaning people. It never occurred to me that Paul had put it there. But the dumbest part of all was I left my full quart. And you know, after we came to the program, I looked for that scotch and it was all gone. Paul must have thought he had a bonanza. Anyway, another thing that happened too, because I don't know, the last 3-4 years we didn't go anywhere at all. And so I went, one of the psychiatrists asked me if I had a hobby. Well, I didn't have a hobby. I worked and waited to go to bed at night. And that was my life. So I thought, well, maybe that'll do it. So the first thing I tried, we had gone to a dinner party at some doctor's house, and this woman was talking about the knitting machine she had bought. Now, I don't even know how to knit by hand, but anyway, I went out and I bought the biggest knitting machine that I could find, and I got 10 free lessons. Well, I never did learn to knit on that dumb thing, because if I dropped a stitch, I didn't know what to do. So I put the knitting machine, which was huge, in our back bedroom, and finally when Paul came to the program, he told me if I didn't get rid of it, he was going to throw it out. So it was brand new. I sold it for half price. Anyway, so then when that didn't work out, I thought, well, I always wanted to play the organ. So I bought an organ, and I got 10 free lessons. And I never did learn to play that organ either. So then a friend of mine was taking painting lessons in somebody's garage. And I thought, well, you know, I always wanted to paint. So I went down and I took painting lessons. And this woman had us mix, we'd spend an hour mixing paint. And I had this palette, it was just full of different colors of blue because I was painting an ocean. And when I had to bring the paint home and put it in the freezer every time I painted to keep it. And we had this Cocker Spaniel, and when I drove in the garage and I opened the door, Paul opened the door into the garage and this Cocker came out, jumped in the car, jumped in all the paint, then ran in the living room and we had these all blue marks on our, as Paul called it, our scotch-colored rug. And I threw the dog out and called the teacher and asked her what I did, what should do about it. She said, well, use a little turpentine. So I did that with the spots. And then I got the bright idea that if I put the dog in the service porch sink and put turpentine in there, it would take it out. Well, that dog went crazy. And so we decided to give her a Milltown and Better Living Through Chemistry was our way of life. And then the dog, you know how a baby would go, and that's what she was doing. So I was holding her, so we let her sleep with us so she wouldn't die. And in the morning, we had to give her a cup of coffee to wake her up. But anyway, I finally finished this picture, and it was really a stormy, stormy ocean. But I was so proud that it looked like something that I got it framed, and I hung it up in the office. And Paul had a patient who'd had a lot of psychiatric care, and he came in and looked at that, and he said, what were you angry about? So I'm not angry. Anyway, until Paul no longer was in practice, that picture hung there, and I don't know what happened to it now. I think we threw it out. And then anyway, I've gone on. I mean, I still have problems with with hobbies. I can't get involved in something else. Right now I'm doing China painting, and I'll see something and I think, gee, that would be fun. No, because I have all these things that I've started, like needlepoint. I have enough needlepoint canvases to start my own store, I think. But anyway, that's what I'm into now, and I enjoy it. And an interesting thing happened to me, because I've been doing it for maybe 10 years. This fellow came from New Orleans and he knew Paul and he'd been in the meeting, so Paul brought him by for breakfast. And he was looking at my painting, and he said, I'd like to be your agent. And I don't know. I could just see me giving him all my pictures and him going off to New Orleans, and I'd never see him again. So I have a problem with that. If it's something I like, I don't want to give it away or sell it. And if I don't like it, then it's not worth selling. But anyway, so then that was on a Monday, and I think Wednesday he saw us at the AA meeting. He came running out to the parking lot, and he said, I'd like to buy one of your paintings. And Paul said, well, you better set a price because she doesn't know. So he said, well, I'll give you $100 for that pen. And I said, well, that's different. You're going to give me money. I have yet to see the money. And I haven't seen him either. But I don't know. Even if nothing happens, it built my self-esteem up a little bit to have somebody even offer. I have learned many, many things on Al-Anon. I am more comfortable than I've ever been in my life. What time did I start? I don't want to run this over too much. You're probably tired of sitting there. Besides, Paul still has to talk. And this is not the first time that I've run over. We've had an hour to share at times. And I would look at my watch, and I had talked 50 minutes and gave him 10. But I think that's only fair because he talks a lot more than I do. I was trying to think of some of the other things. We had built our house in Anaheim and lived there for 21 years, and I thought that we were going to live there forever. Well, in 1979, we started the move, and we moved 5 times in 6 years. And today, I feel that I'm not going to move anymore. I'll turn my will and my life over to God and everything except moving. And if my higher power wants to move, he's going to have to move by himself, because that's hard work, you know, to move. And in one of our moves, Paul told me he had a bad back, and he couldn't help me with the moving. And so I was lugging all these big boxes and stuff around, and I noticed a film in front of my eye, and I thought, oh, well, it'll go away. Well, 6 weeks later, we're still there, and I figured maybe I better have it checked with the doctor. But we were in a new area, and I didn't know any of the doctors. And when I called to make the appointment, the gal asked me how long I'd had it, and I said a month. So she set the appointment up for another month. And I knew what she was thinking. She probably thought it couldn't be very important if I'd let it go that long. Anyway, when Paul came home from the hospital that night, I asked him to look in my eye with his ophthalmoscope, and he couldn't see anything. And I don't know why I did this, but I put my hand over my good eye, and I could only see him from the eyebrows up. And when I told him that, he got on the phone and made an emergency call, for not for the doctor to come, but for me to go in his office. And I saw him about 5:30 the next day, and he told me I had a detached retina. And since they didn't know when it happened, he said that I would either lose the sight in that eye, or I would have double vision if I didn't lose the sight. And I had to have surgery right away. So by 9 o'clock that night, I was in the hospital, in bed, with my eyes bandaged. And I lay there and I thought, you know, I could be mad at Paul because I had mentioned it to him several times, but he didn't act like it was very important. Or I could have been mad at myself because I'd had trouble with that eye before. And I thought, well, you know, what good would that do me? You know, this was reality and I was going to have to accept it. And I had learned in Al-Anon that acceptance was not approval. I didn't have to approve of something to accept it. So I was very comfortable and went to sleep. And the next morning I went down to surgery. And it turned out the assistant surgeon was a doctor I knew who was on the program. And I went into that surgery very comfortable. And I ended up, I lost a little sight in that eye and never did have double vision. So I am convinced that if I'm willing to turn my will and my life, except moving, over to the care of God, that it's going to turn out okay. And I've had lots of experiences with that every time I let go, when I first knew, I would have to try all my methods first. And when they didn't work, I'd think, I don't care what happened. And then something would happen that I hadn't even thought of. And it was always better than anything. So each time it's been easier for me to let go. I had some surgery before that one time, and I was in the hospital, and I was in this Catholic hospital, and this pastoral nun came in the night before, and she said, "You're going to have surgery, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "You're scared, aren't you?" I said, "No." And she said, "Of course you are." And I just thought to myself, "Lady, you don't have a program, you know." Anyway, when I say that I'm grateful for the program, I really am, because it has taught me a whole new way to live, something that I don't think I would ever have found on my own. And like I said, when we moved, we ended up in Washington State. And I hope there's nobody here from there, but I didn't like the meetings up there at all. And so I was glad when we moved back to California, where I was used to the way the meetings, the way they were right, of course. They did a lot of things up there that I certainly wasn't used to. There was a lot of crosstalk, and they didn't believe that you should pay attention to conference-approved material to talk about in the meetings. So it was very strange and foreign to me. And so it was good to get back. But the strange thing, we were out of Orange County for 7 years, I think. And when I went back to the meeting I had started at, there was maybe a half a dozen people that I knew. And everybody else was new. But of course, I've learned now that I know them too, because we've been back 7 years. And I am very, very grateful that Paul's an alcoholic, so we could find this way of life. Thank you.